So what we're going to be talking about is contrasting views of the Great Depression. So I don't know if anyone's explained the protocol. Normally what happens is that the lectures where it's to everybody, they don't usually take Q&A at the end, but then when it's the concurrent sessions, we'll usually try to leave some time at the end for questions. So I'll do that in this talk. What I want to do is give you guys an overview, as the title suggests, of just different perspectives. So I'm not going to, like, once I present a particular viewpoint, I'm not going to take the time then and walk you through the problems with it, because I want to give time for all of the various viewpoints I want to cover and then leave time at the end for your questions. So first of all, what I'm going to call the bad teacher's account of the Depression. So this is, first of all, just gives me an excuse to put up that picture. But other than that, it's always a good way to start an economics lecture. This is what I mean by this is what I certainly learned going through grade school, and probably if you're at least in the United States, what you learned, and I imagine also foreign guests, you learned something similar. So one thing is that the stock market crash was caused by unregulated margin trading. So this was just reported as fact in my history classes growing up. So that what they're trying to explain is how come it was in 1929, all of a sudden there was a huge crash in the stock market, and one of the common things that we learned was that, oh, it's because this was before the era of wise, benevolent government intervention. There wasn't the SEC. There weren't all these things that, thank goodness, had been created during the New Deal in response to this craziness. You know, can you imagine people were allowed to borrow money from anybody and go buy stocks on Wall Street in the 1920s? And so that, of course, led to this huge speculative boom that then collapsed in 1929 and caused the Great Depression. So that's the standard narrative that you'd often hear. So the term margin trading means that you're like borrowing money to then go buy the stocks. And so the reason that was supposed to be a problem is if the stock went down just a little bit, then, you know, your cushion would get wiped out, the amount that the skin that you had in the game, and so then you'd get a margin call. And so then, like, in other words, let's say you bought a stock for 100, so you put in 10 and you borrowed 90 and you bought the stock at 100, well, then it starts dropping, and if it gets down to 90, well, then, and if it dropped lower than that, you see, now all of a sudden the equity you had in it is gone, and so even if you sold it, you wouldn't be able to repay the loan. So the idea is if the stock started dropping a little bit, everybody who had bought on margin now are getting margin calls, so what do they have to do? They got to sell the stocks, and so it sets up this vicious accelerating cycle where people are selling because the price dropped a little bit, and then that just caused more and more selling. Okay, another standard thing that you would learn is that, why do we have the Great Depression? Oh, because Herbert Hoover sat in the White House and did nothing. And, you know, he had this quaint view of the Constitution, of the proper role of the federal government, and again, thank goodness, FDR came in and had a more modern, sophisticated, benevolent view. And that's why the Great Depression was so bad. And so, I'm exaggerating a little bit, setting up a little bit of a straw man, but not much. I mean, this really is certainly the verbal commentary you would get. And I've imagined in the actual printed textbooks, the history books, it would be a little bit better. But this was the standard idea, that Herbert Hoover was not willing to assist anyone. Okay, and then if that's what caused the stock market crash and the Great Depression, then how did we get out of it? Two different variants, either because of the New Deal or people will say because of World War II. And then, you know, that's what got us out of the Depression. And ironically, if you're more of in the U.S. political scene, a liberal, a left-winger, you would focus on this more, and you would say things like, even if it didn't just get us out of the Depression, but, you know, those were very good social programs, a lot of things that are considered just standard component now of the federal government's benefit packages that it offers to Americans were instituted during the New Deal. And then even a lot of sort of right-wing conservatives, what they'll say is, oh, it's not the New Deal that got us out of the Depression, it's World War II. And so that's kind of funny on the face of it, because they're basically being Keynesians then, right? These people that would normally hate, you know, the Obama stimulus package and say, oh, government spending doesn't do anything, that doesn't cure unemployment. The people like on right-wing talk radio, if you're familiar with that genre, Fox News, that sort of mentality, a lot of them, if you ask them how did the U.S. get out of the Great Depression, they would say World War II. And it's partly, I think, because the one government program they like is the military, that but also, you know, it seems to take the credit away from FDR, and, you know, to take it away from the New Deal and to give it to something else. So, but like I say, it's ironic because they are implicitly admitting then that, yes, government spending does promote economic growth, does create jobs. It's just if the government has to spend it on tanks and not on soup kitchens and things like that. Okay, what about Paul Krugman's account? So, again, I'm not going to dwell on this too much, but I do want you to understand his perspective. So he stresses the role of expansionary deficit spending, as you probably know. And what he'll do, like the way he'll try to make his historical case, is say we have precedent that nowadays, and during the Great Recession, we don't want policymakers to engage in what he calls austerity prematurely. And he said, because look at the lessons from history. For example, he'll say, back in 1932, Herbert Hoover foolishly listened to some of his sort of hard money advisors and the people who were treating government like a household and who were saying, well, gee, the economy's really bad. Everybody else is tightening their belts. Maybe the federal government should do that as well. And Krugman's saying that was a disaster, that they tried to shrink the budget deficit in 1932, and then that made that was the worst period of the Depression, that it made things get worse. And then FDR in 37, a similar thing, Krugman says that he also listened to his advisors who convinced him to back off on the deficit spending, and that's when you had the double dip. All right, and I'll show you slides in a little bit if you don't know exactly what I'm talking about, that it's not that there was just one unmitigated disaster of the 1930s that was the Depression. It actually got really bad in the early 30s, then there was a slight recovery, and then it crashed again in 37, 38. So Krugman thinks it's crystal clear, just look at history, to see that these foolish people who are worried about balancing the budget, the last thing in the world you want to do in the midst of a massive depression, Krugman would say, is balance the budget. And I can prove it. Look at what happened in 32 and 37. He also says that conventional monetary policy was hindered by what he calls the liquidity trap, and at the time, specifically in the 30s, the gold standard. So because Herbert Hoover was still operating on the gold standard, the Fed's hands were tied, and they couldn't do what proper policy would have suggested. So I think most of you were probably in the last talk I gave earlier today on this issue about the liquidity trap, so I'll just run through this particular aspect fairly quickly. Krugman's standard position is, and it's hard to catch him on it because technically you would want to have like a liberal Democrat in the White House when interest rates were at like 5% and there was a recession to see if he's for or against stimulus spending in that scenario. But he claims he's not always for deficit spending during a recession. He said, no, what his actual position is that normally just leave it up to the central bank. Let the central bank cut interest rates to stimulate aggregate demand. But then when there is scope for deficit spending is when you're in what's called a liquidity trap. And Krugman, loosely speaking, defines that as a situation where nominal interest rates have been pushed down to zero. And so then the central bank can no longer gain traction. And one way of thinking about it is they're saying they're just swapping different assets for each other, that when the Federal Reserve engages in open market operations, when interest rates are 0%, what are they doing? They're creating more money and then using it to buy, typically, U.S. treasuries. And so if you're somebody in the private sector and you're holding U.S. treasuries that yield 0%, you know, that's like an asset from the federal government yielding 0%, and then the Fed comes in and buys that from you, like if the Fed buys $1 billion of treasuries from you and gives you $1 billion in currency, they're going to say, in a sense, when interest rates are virtually zero, you're kind of, that doesn't really do anything. Because they're just taking $1 billion of things that yield zero and are assets backed up by the federal government and giving you federally backed legal tender that earns 0%. And so it's kind of equivalent. That's one argument that Brad DeLong makes, for example, to try to show why conventional open market operations don't do anything. You're, you know, pushing on a string, that's a famous phrase, when you get into the so-called liquidity trap. So he said the easy way out of that, obvious way, is the federal government runs a budget deficit, because then you can boost aggregate demand because the federal government spends more And yeah, people in the private sector, if they have rational expectations, might anticipate higher tax payments down the road and save more, but they're not going to perfectly offset it one for one. And so you could still on net cause more total investment and consumption expenditure. That's the mentality. Okay, and then if you ask him, you know, okay, but why did we get into this problem in the first place? Why is it that aggregate demand was so insufficient in the early 1930s? Why is it that you think Herbert Hoover should have run massive budget deficits? And Krugman's explanation is to say that there was private debt overhang, so that there were bubbles in the 20s, excessive speculation and so forth, and Krugman obviously would agree that it's because there wasn't enough oversight by government regulators or the Federal Reserve at that time, and markets are inherently unstable, or they can be, and now because people in the private sector in the early 30s had all this debt load they were carrying, that they couldn't be the ones to go out and spend. And so that's why it was up to the government to fill the void. Okay, and then he also has said in several venues, why did the Depression end? He said, oh, because of the jobs program known as World War II. And he said things. Now, if you want to, you can try to grab Krugman and sort of make it look like he's saying right now, if only we could have another war, that would solve all our problems. And he does come dangerously close to saying that, but strictly speaking, his point is to say that back then, the only thing that could get policymakers to abandon their old-fashioned notions about responsible government and fiscal rectitude and so forth was the threat of the Nazis taking over. And that's what finally jolted them and allowed them to start spending a lot of money is after, you know, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. And he's saying that, you know, it's too bad it took something like that to get policymakers to do the right thing, which in his mind was running the massive budget deficits that characterized World War II for the United States government. And that's why, I mean, I'm sure some of you have heard Krugman saying, if only we were convinced that aliens were going to invade, but then they actually didn't invade, it was all a hoax, that would be a good thing. Because fearing the alien invasion, he said this a few years ago on TV, in case people think I'm just making this up. If you just go to YouTube, type in Krugman alien invasion, you'll see what I'm talking about. So he was trying to illustrate his perspective and saying if we'd been persuaded that aliens were going to invade, governments around the world would be spurred into action. You know, no longer would the right wing budget hawks be worrying and penny pinching, talking about austerity. They would all agree, yeah, we need to run big deficits now to deal with this threat. And then once it turned out to be a hoax, we would have all these, you know, laser cannons and whatever else we would have developed. And even if they were a complete waste, it wouldn't matter because just that spending per se would have generated jobs and kickstarted us out of this slump. And so he used that as a fanciful way to try to motivate his perspective. Okay, Friedman and Anna Schwartz, so this, a lot of you guys, since you're so knowledgeable in these areas, probably already know this, but let me just make sure we don't leave anyone behind. It's interesting. They actually, there's a sense in which Milton Friedman blames the Federal Reserve for the Great Depression. And a lot of us, and so this included me, when I was younger and I was a budding free market economist and I was, you know, while everyone else was out having fun, I was sitting at home reading these books. And I came across Friedman's account of the Depression and I liked it and I latched onto it because up till then, you know, I had seen free market critiques of tariffs and critiques of the minimum wage and things like that, and that all made sense to me. But I still had this lingering doubt that I got from my history lessons when I was a little kid, thinking we had a laissez-faire economy, it blew up and led to the Great Depression, and then we got a much more expansive federal government intervening in things and regulating like crazy, and we haven't had a Great Depression since. And so if that's what you think history was, it's kind of hard for you to be a real rabid free marketeer and principled to the extreme because you're kind of thinking, well, within limits, maybe this liberty stuff works, economic freedom, but you know, it does kind of seem like when it was totally unregulated, it blew up and caused the Great Depression. So that's why I liked Friedman's hypothesis when I realized, oh, he's saying it was the Fed that caused the Great Depression, because you can see how rhetorically and ideologically that lined in with my perspective, because the Fed clearly is not a market-based institution. But you got to be careful with that, because it's actually what Friedman and Schwartz were saying is that the problem with the Fed is that they didn't inflate enough in the early 1930s. And that's what the Fed's mistake was. And that's what allowed what should have been just a run-of-the-mill recession or slight downturn instead festered into all these banking crises and the Great Depression as we know it. So let me just walk you through this particular point here. Friedman is not saying that the Fed deliberately destroyed part of the money stock, and that's not what happened. The subtlety is if you have to know how fractional reserve banking works. So I don't want to spend too long on this point because it gets kind of complicated if you've never heard it, but let me just give you the basics. So as you guys all know, I'm sure, our commercial banking system is not 100% reserve. It's what's called a fractional reserve system. So when you go to a commercial bank with $100 in cash and deposit it in your checking account, they don't just put it in a drawer with your name on it. They lend out a lot of it to somebody else. So let's just say it's 10%, that they keep $10 in the drawer and lend out $90 to somebody else. So in that act that I just described of me taking $100 in cash, putting it in a commercial bank, them taking $10 and putting it in the vault and lending $90 to somebody else, the standard measures of the quantity of money like M1, M2, M3, those all just went up by $90 in what I just explained right there. All right, because I didn't, what I think I have is money when I turned it from $100 in currency into $100 in a checking account balance, because from my perspective as the depositor, that's what happened, that still is going to be included in those various monetary aggregates, right? Checking account balances are included in the money stock. So the fact that I swapped from currency into checking account balance, that doesn't make the money supply go down. So that's still $100. But now somebody else out there just had it go up by $90, right? Because they had either they got the $90 in cash or the bank could have given them a loan on their books. And so if their ATM balance goes up by $90. Okay, so somebody in the economy just got $90 more added to his or her cash balance and no one's cash balance went down. So that's the sense in which the bank, by engaging in that fractional reserve loan, increased the quantity of money. All right, so if the banking system is like that, and now all of a sudden everybody gets panicked and think the banks are vulnerable, and they run to their local bank and there's a run on the bank, and everyone's trying to pull out their bank deposits because they want to hold cash rather than having it on deposit at the bank, well, then that process goes in reverse. So if I now go to my bank and say, give me that $100 back, and they do it, well, and then they have to call in the loan example from that one person. And so they can go ahead and do that, and now the quantity of money just shrank by $90. So that's what was happening in the early 30s with all these bank runs in the United States. So the quantity of money in terms of like M1 or M2 or M3, that shrank. And so that exacerbated people's unwilling, people were hoarding money. They wanted to hold money in general. And then on top of that, the type of money they wanted to hold, the form of it, they didn't want it to be in a bank deposit. They wanted it to be actual currency because that was safer for obvious reasons. So all those things contributed to this drop in willingness of people to spend, and that caused prices to fall significantly. So Friedman is saying what the Fed should have done to offset that is they should have entered the market and engaged in all kinds of open market operations to increase the what's called the quantity of base money to offset this trend that because the public wants to hold more money in the form of currency, that it would normally cause the quantity to shrink. So he's saying they should have offset it so that the actual quantity of money didn't shrink. So that's what his claim is. And so he said because they failed to do that, that's the sense in which the Fed can be blamed for gross incompetence during the early 30s. Okay, another important point he makes that's being brought up a lot today, there are what's called market monetarists. Their leader is Scott Sumner. Many of you may have heard of him. And this is a point that Friedman made in reference to Japan and also reference to the 1930s. And he was saying that the problem is people were looking at low interest rates and saying that means the central bank is having an easy money policy. And Friedman is saying, no, you can't just look at interest rates. And so going the other way, for example, I have never read this directly, but people have reported that during the German hyperinflation, there were certain Keynesians who were saying that, no, it's not the central bank's fault. It's not that they're printing too much, too many Deutschmarks or whatever. It's that the And how do they know that? They said, well, because look, at the interest rates are pretty high in Germany. They're a lot higher in Germany than they are in other countries that aren't experiencing hyperinflation. So clearly, it's not that monetary policy is too easy. So you can see the problem there, that once that hyperinflation got underway, price inflation was really significant. And so somebody would charge a lot in a nominal interest rate on a loan. It could be they could if prices were going to rise 100%, you might charge 110% on your loan, or you could try to say, let's say it this way, 101% on your loan, and that's still 101% alone sounds like, wow, that's a really high interest rate. But if prices are rising 100%, well, then it's actually pretty low, if you get what I'm saying. So that was the problem in a hyperinflationary regime, and Friedman's saying it was the opposite mistake in the 1930s. People were looking at the fact that interest rates were low, that the Fed was cutting interest rates, and concluding, well, the Fed's trying to help, but obviously it's not taking, and problem must lie elsewhere. And that's actually what a lot of people, including me, are saying nowadays, that look at, clearly the issue here is not that the Fed's being insufficiently generous with its policy. Look at, they cut interest rates to zero. What more do you want them to do? And so Friedman, in reference to the great U.S. and the Great Depression and then Japan in the late 90s, was making the point that, no, think about it. If the central bank had a very tight policy, you would also see low interest rates, because if they tightened too much or they didn't expand enough in light of an increased demand to hold money, well, then you'd see falling prices and then falling nominal interest rates as people adjusted to the new situation. And so you could see very low nominal interest rates, but it would be wrong to conclude, oh, the Fed's got an easy policy. All right, so that's his point there. Okay, Murray Rothbard's account. This was actually taken, I think, in 1987. So what he says, and this is the standard Austrian view at this point, that the Fed created an artificial stock market boom, and that which inevitably ended in the 1929 crash. So that's one way of thinking about it. If you read the Friedman account, he keeps looking at that there's various periods throughout the 1920s when there was a little hiccup and the economy slowed and the stock market started to fall, and then the Fed came in and bought assets and flooded the market with new liquidity, and then the boom resumed. And so, but for whatever reason, and there's like the guy Benjamin Strong died, and there's various institutional infighting that was going on that might explain why they stopped doing that in 28 and 29. But for whatever reason, the Fed kind of backed off in 28 and 29, and then the whole thing collapsed. So Friedman's perspective is they could have just done that forever, that they showed that there was no problem. You could always just get through these little hiccups if you just inflated more and more, and they could have just done that forever. There was no reason for the stock market to crash, whereas the Austrian perspective is to say the whole time they were blowing up an unsustainable bubble, and at some point it was going to come crashing down, and the further they persisted, the longer they kept that thing going, the harder the crash was going to be. Okay, and now given that, and this is a subtle point too in terms of how do Austrians explain their position. So a lot of times people will say, oh, the Austrians think that the Fed caused the Great Depression, or the Austrian, like Ron Paul, thinks that Bernanke caused the Great Recession. And that's not quite right. That strictly speaking, what Murray Rothbard says is that the 1929 crash was caused by the prior unsustainable boom that the Fed caused. But then why did it take 10 years of an awful, agonizing Great Depression? That was because of the way the Hoover administration and FDR's administrations responded to it. All right, because given that there was an unsustainable boom and a crash, if there had been a perfectly laissez-faire response, that just would have blown through the system and been cleaned out within 18 months or so, just like it had historically, that there had been really bad crises, or they called them panics in earlier times, that had then been purged from the system, to use the phrase that I think Andrew Mellon used, that a lot of Keynesians now are horrified by, but it was true, that things got reallocated very quickly relative to the decade of the Depression. Okay, Robert P. Murphy's account. So, in here, it's not that what I'm saying, of course, is distinct from what Rothbard is saying. It's just I'm elaborating on some of the themes that he started. So this is a point that Tom Woods also has been hitting on too, that if you go and look at what's called the Depression of 1920 and 21, and I've got a Freeman article on this. So if you go to Google and type in something like the Depression You've Never Heard Of, 1920-21, I have an article, and I think Tom has a talk that he gave at some Mises event that's on YouTube if you want to see this, you know, a talk instead. And it's just amazing if you go through this. It's almost like you couldn't have asked for a better refutation of the standard Keynesian and monetarist explanation. So just step back a minute and think about it. The Keynesian explanation for what happened is that the government didn't run a big enough deficit, and that's why the 1930s were so bad. And the monetarist or Chicago school explanation is the Fed didn't inflate enough, and that's why the 1930s were so bad. So just even before we look at the historical record, there's something fishy about that type of explanation, because they're saying the reason the 1930s was the worst economy in modern world history is because of a failure for the president or the executive branch and the Federal Reserve to do enough. So, but everyone agrees that before then, the executive branch and the Federal Reserve didn't do anything of that scale either. You know, if you get what I'm saying? So it's weird to say because Hoover and FDR didn't depart enough from the, or sorry, because Hoover and the people run the Federal Reserve didn't depart enough from what their predecessors has been doing, that's why they got hit with the worst thing ever. See what I'm saying? So that doesn't quite add up. How come we didn't have a Great Depression in the 1830s? Because clearly back then they didn't run big budget deficits to fight a depression, and the central bank didn't do all kinds of inflation in order to offset the fall in M1. Right? That's not what they did in the 1830s. So it's weird for them even just rhetorically to try to explain why things all of a sudden changed and we had this completely unprecedented catastrophe by saying they didn't, you know, they were still basically doing business as usual and they didn't depart enough and do what we think the right things are. So that's odd on its face. But beyond that, we have this specific example of the 1920 and 21 depression where the government and monetary authorities did the exact opposite, that they drastically cut government spending by something like 67% over 2 or 3 years. And the central bank jacked up interest rates to what were then record highs, and they crashed the monetary base. And there was, and price deflation was more severe in the first 12 months of this than in any 12-month period during the Great Depression. Okay, so for any of the specific reasons that the Keynesians, the monetarists will say, oh, this is why that stock market crash was then exacerbated and led into the Great Depression, you know, those things, if that narrative is true, then the 1920s should have been far worse than the 1930s. And yet, it's not merely that, oh yeah, it was pretty awful, the 1920s, but just wasn't as bad. As I'm sure many of you know, the 1920s were called the Roaring Twenties, right? The 1920s were considered to be, you know, probably one of the most prosperous decades in U.S. history, where people were getting cars for the first time, or they were getting electrification. People were, you know, they were connecting people and getting radios for the first time, or washing machines, all sorts of things like that. So it was just, again, to the extent that you could have in macroeconomics a controlled experiment. It's not a controlled experiment. Things were different. There wasn't a banking crisis. They were unwinding expenditures from World War I, so that's partly why they had those massive budget cuts and so forth. So, yeah, there were differences, but it is true to say that they clearly did things that Keynesians and monetarists were saying were awful, and lo and behold, there was a really bad depression. They call it depression with a small d, but it was over in 2 years, and then you had what went down in history as the Roaring Twenties. In contrast, they did run budget deficits, as we'll see in a minute, under Hoover and FDR. The central bank did engage in what was at the time considered radical, unconventional monetary policy to try to help things. And lo and behold, they had the worst decade in history. So just again, the prima facie case, it's funny, the Austrians have famously, at least in the tradition of Mises, don't go to the historical record to try to empirically prove their theories or anything like that, but it is true that it does seem that history often does seem to line up quite nicely with the narrative that we're saying, whereas the Keynesians have to, and the monetarists have to explain things away. Okay, so another way that I like to put this, when people say, oh yeah, FDR got us out of the Depression, and I say, well, what would things have to be like for you to agree that the New Deal made the Depression worse, right? What would have to happen? Because I'll show you in a minute the unemployment figures, that they were awful for 8 years after he took office. And so, you know, one way to think about it is it's not enough just that you were in office when the Depression officially ended to say he ended it. Because historically, depressions had always eventually come to an end. And so the fact, so what you want to look at is to say the severity of them and the speed with which the economy pulled out of it. And so under any kind of reasonable metric, the U.S. suffered worse because of the New Deal, whether you're comparing it to previous or later depressions, or whether you're looking at, say, Canada, that if you look at Canada and the U.S. side by side and their unemployment rates, after FDR comes into office, the gap widens so that Canada's, you know, their unemployment rate improves much more quickly than the U.S. unemployment rate does. So you can't even just say, well, FDR inherited such a big mess, you got to give them, cut them some slack. Well, the Canadians were in a big mess too, and yet for some reason, you know, their policymakers were able to do things better. And they didn't have a comparable Canadian New Deal at the time. So it wasn't that, oh, the Canadians had the courage to engage in bigger government than FDR did. Okay, Bob Higgs account. So if you don't know, this isn't actually Bob Higgs. This is, what this is, this guy, it's from the show Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David. And there's, I forget which season it is, but if you have the various seasons on disc, there's one of them where, you know how you put the DVDs in, and before you choose the episode, it just keeps looping a few things. There's one where he hires a plumber who comes over, and he sounds just like Bob Higgs in that little clip. So you should look for that one. You take nothing else out of this lecture. Okay, so what's Bob Higgs' account? Again, this is all consistent with the Austrian Rothbardian story, but there's just some nuances that Bob Higgs brought to the record. So his big terminology is what's called regime uncertainty, and he points out how that crippled private investment under the New Deal. So the figures there, the statistics are shocking in terms of that, you know, it was, I didn't go look the numbers up, so I don't have them exactly at my fingertips, but in terms of just businesses weren't even replacing their capital as it was being worn out, on net, you had a reduction in the capital stock for several years into the Roosevelt administration. And Higgs is saying one of the reasons for that is, look, if you're a business person and you're going to make long-term investments, you need to know what the rules of the game are going to be. And there were lots of people who were wondering whether FDR was going to be a dictator, for example. You know, and they had like surveys that were conducted for businessmen. And that, to us now, in retrospect, we say, oh, well, that obviously was a silly worry. But, I mean, he did serve for several, you know, the precedent before then, the tradition was that you'd only serve two terms in office as president, and then you would retire and do something else. And FDR broke that tradition. And then, of course, around the world, there were strong men who were running their countries. And there were many respects in which FDR was emulating that. He was certainly breaking all the barriers of what had conventionally be considered the proper role of the executive branch and so forth. So anyway, regime uncertainty is one thing that Higgs brings up to say people didn't know what the property rights were going to be. And so that's one reason you wouldn't invest. And then he has a lot of excellent work that even mainstream economists and historians endorse and recognize the good work he did here on World War II spending not ending the Depression. And I'll come back to that in a minute and show you specifically. Okay, so let me just run through some quick things here about Hoover versus FDR. They both propped up wages and farm prices. They both engaged in massive tax hikes and deficits. In particular, Hoover, in the 1932, so Krugman is right that Hoover tried to close the deficit, but it was through relatively modest spending cuts and enormous tax rate increases. They didn't, in practice, end up bringing in that much revenue, but just because they were so crippling that the tax base shrunk. All right. So in my book, for example, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and New Deal, I have two charts and show the huge tax rate increases. Rothbard also talks about it in his book, America's Great Depression. Okay, and they both engaged in what we are now referred to as public works. So let me just run you through some of these statistics. So this is federal spending by fiscal year, and you can see that consistently went up under the Hoover administration. And, you know, and this was back when $1 billion meant something. So you can see So look, you know, going from three, like this doesn't seem like a lot in our terms, like, oh, just a few billion dollars. But again, starting from a base of just $3 billion and change, that's a pretty big increase, especially when the economy is collapsing and prices are collapsing. So in real terms, you know, it would be even bigger. And then you can see the surplus or the deficit as a share of GDP. So down here, this is from the reason for these odd dates is these are when the fiscal years were. If you're wondering why am I picking the dates this way, that's because this is like fiscal 1931. So you can see how that increased. So it's not enormous by today's standards, but it's not true to say that Herbert Hoover sat back and did nothing. Again, the most you could say as a Keynesian is, well, yeah, he increased spending even though tax revenues were collapsing and even though the purchasing power of money was increasing, and he ran progressively bigger deficits even as the economy was collapsing, but he just didn't do enough. He should have run even bigger deficits. That's the most you can say. You can't say that Herbert Hoover was this laissez-faire small government deficit hawk. Okay, a famous public work. Does anyone know what that is? Hoover, yeah, what's could have been referred to as the Hoover Dam. All right. Strictly speaking, if you go and look at that, I was hoping it'd be a smoking gun and that Herbert Hoover pushed this through to boost aggregate demand and so forth. And it was in progress before then. And so it's actually not, I mean, it did get built and it is called the Hoover Dam. And anyway, it wasn't like he was against it or anything. But my point is, unfortunately, this is not something that he viewed as a specific means to create employment during the Depression. Okay, this one might surprise you. This comes from Rothbard, dug this up. So an editorial in the Federationist, this was a labor union, or American Federation, a labor union magazine. This was in early 1930, right? So this is shortly after the stock market crash. What happened is Herbert Hoover called in all the big business leaders and said to them, look at before, whenever there's a big economic crisis, traditionally, everybody just has a, you know, it's all looking out for myself mentality. And individual business owners just worry about their own books, and they lay workers off. You know, if revenue falls, they lay off workers and so on. And he said, but come on, we got to have a big perspective here. If all of you do that, if you act in your own narrow self-interest and just lay off workers and look out for your own bottom line, well, look at your rising unemployment, where are the customers going to be for everyone else's businesses, right? And so you're all cutting each other's throats if you do that. So let's all band together, maintain wages above all, because we got to have enough purchasing power in the hands of the public. And if something's got to take the hit, have it be profits or interest, but don't cut wages and don't lay people off, right? And so you can see that Herbert Hoover was the hero, the darling of the labor unions originally. And it was only after it didn't work and unemployment got to be so high that he then turned into this heartless, cruel man in the White House who doesn't care about workers. Okay, to give a sense of how did the, you know, this claim, did FDR get us out of the Great Depression? Well, you can see, so the election was in 32, and then he was sworn in early 33. So you can see, okay, when he comes into office, unemployment does peak this year at roughly 25%, which is, of course, unimaginably bad. And then, yeah, it starts coming down. But even here, this is pretty lackluster reductions. And then, but 37, so that's a full 4 years after he's been in office. And then it jumps back up to 19%. And that's a full 5 years after he's in office. And then it comes down. So you can see it wasn't until 41, which is eight full years later, that unemployment gets below 10%. So this kind of goes back to what I was saying before. What would the numbers have to look like for people to say the New Deal prolonged and made the Depression that much worse, as opposed to saying, well, the New Deal got us out of the Depression, which is still the standard response from people. Okay. Hang on. Let me go over this one. So what I'm going to talk about Higgs's argument about didn't World War II get us out of the Depression? So if you look, so this is the official unemployment rate. So it goes way up and it comes down. And you can see what's causing this big drop. Well, it's happening right during the war years. And so this seems like prima facie. Look, you can say you don't like government spending for ideological reasons. You can say World War II was a mistake and the U.S. shouldn't have gotten into it. But who can deny that it saved the economy? So Higgs points out here, well, hang on. What exactly happened? there was the draft during this period. And so, yeah, the federal government rounded up millions of able-bodied men and put them on ships and sent them overseas to get shot at and shoot at people. And if you want to, and that lowered the official unemployment rate, it's true, but it wasn't even like a one-to-one trade-off. In other words, they had to draft more people than the net reduction in the unemployment rate. So, I mean, even if you, so even just rounding the unemployed up and then sending them overseas, this was worse than that, if you get what I'm saying, right? This was less efficient than that. This was a worse way of creating jobs than even just taking all the unemployed people, you know, giving them a rifle and saying, good luck, and then, you know, saying, oh, we fixed the unemployment problem because now they're all in the military. All right, so that's, you know, so that's one way of seeing it. Let me walk you through this one. So this is the official GDP figures, and these are, I didn't have it up here, I should put real GDP up here. These are corrected for price inflation, supposedly, and I'm going to walk you through in a minute the reason, the subtlety there. Okay, so these are the official real GDP figures. That if you went to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, these are what the historical stats are. So you can see, I don't know if you can, it's kind of small, I know, but this is 1929, 30, 31, 32, 33, like that. So GDP is collapsing, then it bottoms out in 33, and then it starts rising again, and then you see this double dip again, 37 to 38, and then it takes off like a rocket, and these are the war years. And then you see actually there was a slight recession in statistical terms from 45 to 46 because of, you know, the war spending drop. So somebody like Krugman's going to look at this and say, clearly the recovery occurred because of the massive spending of the government. And what Higgs brings up a couple points. So one thing is, let's disaggregate this and look at it in terms of government spending versus private. And then you can see, if you just looked at the private sector, so again, taking the government's own figures, even though there's all kinds of quibbles we could make with the official GDP calculations, just taking the government's own numbers at face value, look at what's happening to private GDP. This is the blue stuff. So it was going down, it was recovering, and then once the war started, it fell lower than at any point, even at the depths of the Great Depression. And, you know, this is what, 1944. All right, so, and remember, and population was bigger then too. So per capita, real private sector GDP was even lower there than this chart would suggest to you. And so what that means is the people on the home front actually were experiencing greater misery, according to the government's own figures, in terms of, you know, how much output are they getting from the economy than at the height or at the depths of the Great Depression. All right, so, and again, this is using the government's own figures. So somebody could say, oh, yeah, but no one's denying that the government was absorbing a big role of it, but the point is, look at total economic output was that much higher. But the problem with that is, the way these numbers are calculated, this figure is that high just because the government spent a bunch of money and they just wrote down those numbers and counted it. All right, so it's, let me put it to you this way. There are problems with it anyway to do it in the private sector, to do GDP just by writing down the numbers. So if, but there is a sense, a certain logic to it, that if you're willing to go out and spend $100 on something, on a television set, and somebody else spends $100 on sweaters and other types of clothes, you say, okay, well, that's $200 of output. And like I said, there's all kinds of problems with that, but the point is, well, the fact that people are willing to spend their money on that so that this person knows he had the option of buying the sweaters or the TVs, and he chose to spend his money on that differently for this person. So there's a sense in which people spending money voluntarily on something is a way, roughly, of gauging it, of aggregating this stuff together to talk about what's total output like. Whereas if the government spends $1 million on a bomber, or, you know, spends $1 million buying more ammunition, there's not the same incentive structure, because what it's not that they can save it and then spend the money elsewhere or pocket the money themselves, because that would be considered corruption. And so the incentives for government, especially when it comes to military expenditures, is not to watch costs, right? They don't shop around and go with the military contractor who delivers the quality merchandise at the lowest possible price. If you know anything about military contracts, that's not at all what happens, right? So it's grossly misleading then to look at this, the height of these columns, and say, oh yeah, that's genuine economic output on the same that should be given the same significance as people in the private sector spending money. Okay, and there's yet another problem. Okay, hang on, let me make the point here, and then I'll show you that graph. Another problem with this that Higgs brought up, it's kind of a subtle point, but it's pretty crucial. So these are supposed to be real GDP figures. So they're supposed to have adjusted for changes in price inflation. And let me just make sure you get the concern or the issue. So let's say you have an economy that's got $1 trillion in output as measured by the GDP stats. So they just look at all the final expenditures on goods and services. They add up how much do people spend as $1 trillion. Okay. Now the government doubles the quantity of money. Let's just assume there's no distributional impact, just all the prices double. Everyone's making twice as much, but prices are twice as high. So next year, what will nominal GDP be? It'll be $2 trillion. It's the same, if it's the same real output, same amount of stuff is being produced, same quantity of TVs and radios and so on. It's just the price tag on everything is now twice as high, and there's twice as many dollar bills floating around. So in that setting, if you just naively counted up the total monetary expenditures, you would say, oh, the economy doubled in size. That's great. But they do have a way to deal with that. They're not that naive. They say, oh, wait a minute. Prices doubled. So if you look at nominal GDP and then have a price deflator, and so if you have like a consumer price index, let's say, and all the prices doubled, so now the CPI is double what it was last year. Once you take that into account, now real GDP is flat. It's the same as it was last year. That's still $1 trillion in last year's money. Okay, so that's the standard way they do these GDP accounts. They have to have a sense of the price level in order to figure out what's real GDP. Because just because people are spending more doesn't mean more stuff is being produced if it's just because prices have risen. Okay, so when it comes now to this, Bob Higgs brought up the point. He said the problem, on top of everything else that I've mentioned, the problem with looking at these huge numbers here is that they are naively taking the official prices for all those goods. So a lot more money is being spent, but that's because the Fed bought a bunch of war bonds and totally inflated the money supply, and so there was a lot of monetary inflation. So of course people are spending more, and of course the government's now able to spend a lot more, but normally you would expect that to have pushed prices up, and that would mean these would all be much lower if you saw the rise in prices. But prices weren't allowed to rise because there was price controls during World War II. All right, so it's an important point. Let me just say it again in different words. If there had been no price controls, these bars would not have been as high because they would have looked at the total nominal spending and then they would have looked at how the prices rose significantly during the war years because of all the inflation, monetary inflation. And so then they would have corrected the nominal figures and said, oh, real GDP didn't grow nearly as much. But Higgs is pointing out they didn't do that in this case. They were just using the standard price indices as reported by the government, and those were the legally permissible prices. So I emailed Bob Higgs, and I said, let me make sure I understand this before I put this in my book, relying on his research. Are you saying the statisticians and the GDP accounts estimated what they thought the real prices should have been if there hadn't been price controls, and you just think they didn't do a good job estimating that? Or are you saying they literally did not even deal with the fact that there were explicit price controls and they just plugged in to compute this stuff? They just plugged in the figures that the government said, these are the prices. And he said the latter. They didn't make no adjustment whatsoever for the fact that there were price controls. So that's... So again, just showing you how completely bogus these figures are, and Higgs even has a thing in there where he compares it to the figures coming out of like the Soviet Union when they would talk about their production output and things like that. And everybody came to realize that these numbers were completely divorced from reality. They were just arbitrary things that some bureaucrat picked. And he was saying that in the GDP accounts, that's the attitude we need to have during the World War II years because of all these different reasons he's bringing up, that those numbers are not comparable to either before or after in the series, that, yeah, there's methodological issues with the whole thing, but in particular, these points in here are just completely incommensurable because there's all sorts of different institutional framework that was operating at that time. Okay, and you can see, if you're wondering, okay, well, how big a deal was the inflation? You can see how big a deal it was. So this is the monetary base. You can see how low it was, and then it comes up during the 30s, and then you can see the massive increase right during the period that we're talking about. So we don't know what price inflation would have been had the government just stood back and let the thing run its course, but it clearly would have been significant. Okay, I'm going to open up to your questions in a minute. Let me just explain if you want further reading here. So this is my book. This is, of the four of these up here, this is the lightest reading. This is like a, you know, if you just want a quick introduction to some of the main points, that's what this is for. This is the definitive Austrian account of the 1920s in the Hoover administration, but unfortunately, Rothbard doesn't go on and talk about the New Deal at all. He ends with the Hoover administration. This is Lionel Robbins' treatment. He's got some really good stuff in there showing how the central banks departed from classical central banker practice in the 1930s, and that they, so you did have easy money in the 1930s, and so again, it's just showing the irony of trying to nowadays blame the Great Depression on inadequacy and unwillingness to act, when in fact the people on the ground at the time were saying, "I can't believe how activist the central banks are. They weren't normally like this." And then this is a collection that has a lot of Bob Higgs's essays on the Depression and also some other things, but his classic work on the Great Depression revisionism is in there. Okay, so why don't I stop there and then I'll take your guys' questions. Yep. Okay, so the question is referring to the 1920s and how can we distinguish between an economy that grows because of government or one that grows in spite of it. So you're right, there is a little bit of a tension there that on the one hand, Austrians want to say that, oh, the 1920s, there was an unsustainable boom caused by easy Fed policies, and then that led to the 29 crash. So in practice, it's I guess it's partly a judgment call, but there was, how can I put it, most economic historians are going to say the 1920s was clearly a period of prosperity, and just the average person thinks the 1920s was a period of prosperity, whereas everyone knows the 30s was awful. And so partly I'm just bringing it up to say it's odd that, you know, the policies these people say would be awful were implemented all the more so in the early 20s, and yet it didn't seem like there was a disaster there. So I guess I'm not sure exactly how to answer your question. There were, let me put it to you this way. So yes, there clearly were some distortions in the 1920s and there was unsustainable growth, but at the same time, there were huge expansions in living standards and all sorts of various measures you could look at to try to see, you know, which, how many people had more electricity and things like that, that I think it's clear that the U.S. standard of living was higher in 1928 than it was in 1923. And even though there would have been a collapse had the government done nothing in the early 30s, then there would have been that still upward expansion. Yep. No, this guy right here, and then I'll go to you. Okay, so the question is, with the regime uncertainty, does the Keynesian model collapse on itself?
Is it self-defeating
because government officials can't be trusted to keep their word? Okay, yeah, so is it a paradox? So if depending on how strong you think the regime uncertainty position is, then yes, I would say that Keynesianism by its very nature is largely... Is it completely self-defeating if you didn't have the other economic theories? I'm not sure. Okay, yeah, so he's clarifying, saying Keynes wanting to decrease uncertainty, is he therefore increasing uncertainty? Yeah, I think that's true. That it's hard to distinguish between, you know, John Maynard Keynes' own particular views and what FDR did during the New Deal. But yeah, certainly Keynes was talking about, you know, the virtues of experimentation and the government officials being willing to do whatever they need to do to get people out of the Depression. And that's what Higgs's point is that if the government officials are openly talking about, hey, we're going to do whatever we need to fix this thing, and we're going to keep trying different stuff until something sticks, that type of attitude itself partly retards the recovery, because now people clam up and they don't want to make investments because they're not sure what the environment's going to be like. Yeah.
Buy it at the price according to the price control. So if GDP expanded with the price of the price control, didn't the consumer benefit? They didn't expand it, but GDP didn't expand, but it had expanded. Didn't buyers bought at the price of price control, and therefore it doesn't matter when I come to GDP.
Okay, so the question is, with price controls in place, wouldn't the consumer benefit because they're still getting to get the goods and services but at a lower price? Is that what you're asking?
No. When GDP increases, uh-huh, and there is price control, and we take into account GDP at the pricing of price control and not of the real monetary inflation, should we take the real monetary inflation if consumers are buying products at
okay, so the question is, if people have more money because of monetary inflation and they're out spending it and nominal GDP is higher, why would we worry about the price controls, because aren't consumers benefiting because it's lower prices? Well, there's two things going on. So one is, what you're not capturing in that is all the rationing. So because there are price controls, because prices are being held below the market clearing level, there's shortages, and so that's one way of seeing that the economy is actually performing less efficiently than the numbers suggest. So people have to wait in line. They have to go get ration cards or whatever the specific mechanisms are in order to get goods and services, whereas if it's just freely floating prices, you don't have to worry about that. But then specifically, if you're wondering, like, what was generating that huge increase in nominal GDP if the people weren't allowed to spend more on nylon stockings and radios, it was because the government was there, right? So there weren't price controls on government stuff, if that's one way you want to think about, or they could have a massive increase in output of military items, and so that's what was driving the increase in the total figure, even though on the private sector side, you were not seeing a big increase in even nominal expenditures. Okay, well, how about one more? This last one right here. Can you make it a one-part question? I'm just thinking we've got 3 minutes. Okay, so the question is, the fact that Europe was in ruins, did the U.S. benefit in the post-World War or post-war era because their trading partners then turned to the U.S.? I mean, other things equal, that would be, you know, one factor involved there. But on the other hand, I mean, with the division of labor and things like that, it doesn't make us poorer, or it doesn't make us richer to have people disappear, right? So if all of a sudden tomorrow all of Europe disappeared, I think on net that would make the United States and everybody else poorer. So yeah, the one specific mechanism could be, oh wait, people who were previously trading with the Europeans now might trade with the United States, but by the same token, stuff we imported from Europe and exported to Europe now can't happen if Europe doesn't exist anymore. So I would say there's various things, and on net, no, I don't think the destruction of Europe on net made the U.S. economically better off in the 50s. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks, everybody.